Coming up today, how social media has changed protest, Wired gets a redesign, and how f***ing swearing makes you f***ing stronger. You're listening to episode 316 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Victoria Wollaston.
Hello.
And a new but old voice, Victoria Turk.
Hi.
Or Vicky Turk. Actually, you're both Vickies.
That's not confusing at all.
No, not at all. So we're going to go with Vicky T and Vicky Woolley.
Well, at one point we were going to... suggested Woolley and Turkey, but that didn't quite work. So I think now I'm just VW and Vicky can keep her name.
Vicky,
yes.
T. Well, as the new person, you can have your fact first, Vicky.
Ooh,
Vicky,
no pressure.
T. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I actually have one for you guys to guess, because I know you love those.
Okay, yes.
So this is based on something I've been playing this week, which is Mario Kart 8 Deluxe on the Switch. I've been getting quite into it. So Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is the fastest selling game in the franchise. How many copies do you think it sold on its first day?
Worldwide.
In the US.
In the US. I don't know. 700,000.
Oh, I hate these sorts of questions because I feel under pressure to actually get near it.
Probably more than that.
1 million.
Okay, you're actually both overestimating.
Oh, really?
Oh,
that's a shame.
Oh, so, no, we've made it. It's like, oh, it didn't do as well as we thought.
But, it was still the fastest selling. So, it's 459,000. But that is only in the US. And that means that nearly half of people who have a Switch console have bought the game.
I saw a stat on Twitter, actually, that said, more copies of Zelda have been sold than Switch consoles have been sold.
Right, yeah, so I've got this one as well. So how many copies do you think that Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild has sold by March 31st?
1 million.
2.2 million.
2.76 million.
Oh, Zing. James, you were close.
Almost.
And that's about... So there's 2.74 million Switches have been sold. So yeah, more copies of the game than the console.
So almost half of the copies of Super Mario Deluxe 8 extra copies of Zelda have been sold compared to...
This is way too much math for a Friday afternoon.
Also, that wasn't pre-planned. I was just mentioning that fact and then Vicky just comes in with that. I mean, it's
magic.
Synergy.
Fitting right in already.
The two Vickies.
Vicky, other Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week that birds have knees.
Great.
So you can't always see them under the feathers, but they bend the same way that our knees bend. So sometimes when you see a bird walking and it looks like their joints are sort of bending backwards, that's actually their ankle. Don't get mistaken. It's not their knee. It's their ankle.
So they have very high ankles and very well hidden knees.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
So like a flamingo, but yeah. All birds have them.
But tiny little legs. Yeah. There you go.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I learned far more prosaically that 1 in 5 British startups are considering moving their headquarters to another European country due to Brexit, according to Silicon Valley Bank's Startup Outlook report. There you go.
Oh.
Yeah. Sad times. And for more thrilling political insight, listen to Upvote, Wired and Ars Technica UK's political podcast with Roland Manthorpe and Kelly Fiveash, the second episode of which is out now, so go and have a listen.
In which Roland Manthorpe imagines what it would be like to have Katie Hopkins as president.
If that's reason not to listen, I don't know what it is. No, go have a listen, it's very good. We should also mention that the new issue of Wired is out now. It's a slightly redesigned issue, so our very talented creative team led by Andrew Diprose have been through and given everything a bit of a polish, a bit of a change. So if you're a long-term subscriber, you'll notice some different things. If you're a newcomer, then it might feel a little more fresh and modern. It looks fantastic. And we'll be talking a little bit about one of the biggest changes, Work Smarter, which is why Vicky Turk has joined us. We'll be talking about that a little later on. But first up, and I should say, I developed the special beeping noise especially for this podcast so that we can talk about swearing while swearing if the mood takes us. So swear a little bit, not too much, because the beep's quite annoying.
Okay, so it's not just swearing, it's swearing while riding a bike.
Okay.
In the name of science.
Good.
Apparently, swearing makes you stronger. I don't mean mentally, I mean physically stronger. It increases your physical strength when you swear, apparently.
And this is proper, rigorous academia at work.
This was done by Keele University and Long Island University in Brooklyn. So what they did is they got 29 participants and to complete these short period of intense, that some of them were cycling on an exercise bike. The rest of them were completing this really strong hand grip test. And what they did, they wanted to measure how strong they were when they were swearing and how strong they were when they weren't swearing.
So the people were frantically pedaling on the bike while swearing like a sailor.
Yeah, like Uncle Jack from Father Ted, just like
Okay. And it works.
Apparently so. It increases. So over the once the resistance was added, there was an initial 4% more power in when they were swearing. Overall, the researchers said there was almost 3% increment with the swearing across 30 seconds.
So is this something that they could implement into the Grand Tour? So on the Tour de France, you might have a load of very tired-looking people cycling up a horrible, horrible incline while just letting rip.
It would be like the new doping, like the new way of cheat. There'd just be these cyclists that sound like they've got some disorder just swearing as they go around the course.
They'd be able to find the most effective words as well.
So why were they even looking at this?
So actually, what they were trying to do is they were trying to determine whether swearing provoked a fight or flight response, like through arousal in the body. But they didn't record any arousal at all. So
they don't know why it was beneficial.
They have no idea.
Huh.
But this isn't the first time that swearing's actually proved to impact the body on this. Previous research has shown that actually can not numb pain, but it reduces how much pain you feel.
As everyone who has really badly stubbed their toe will attest. Going,
yes.
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah. But one of the researchers says we've got a clear effect, but no clear explanation for the effect. So now they're going to do more work just to see like why the body is able to produce more power. What is it about it?
It must be absolute research gold for scientists. But and they go, we found something interesting, but we don't know why.
But then I think it goes the other way. I think the researchers would be frustrated about it because they're like, oh, we know this happens and it's such a difference, it's such an increase in power that it can't just be coincidental. And they're like, oh, we don't know why.
Probably made them swear.
Yes.
Yes, you'd imagine
While on a bike gripping something really hard.
So did anything else come out of the study? It was purely that getting on a bike and just swearing lots makes you a bit faster on a bike.
You say that as if that's not enough. I think that's quite enough for a scientific study to come out and show that your body reacts to swearing. But I mean, the researchers were very keen to point out that there must be this thread. There must be the way that we use these words affect the body. What I think is most interesting about this is they're just words. So why do we assign a certain combination of letters suddenly changes our body and the way our body reacts to something? That is what I think is interesting.
Because it's the way that your brain is activating into this certain mode. So if you were to train yourself that screaming tomatoes over and over again, or maybe it's the sound of the word, like a lot of swear words are quite like sharp and harsh.
Yeah, yeah.
You should suggest that they do that next, the same experiment, but with people saying tomatoes.
Or like kick.
Or exactly, any sort of word that has similar sort of sound.
Shunt. Yeah, I
don't know. Ship.
Ship. Brilliant, brilliant. Okay, so that will be our suggestion to the very earnest academic work. But it's an interesting study.
It really is. I think it really is. But there was also another study this week that showed that language, depending on what language you speak, especially if you're bilingual, can actually affect how you perceive time. Now, it's a lot more complicated than that, and that's part of the reason why I didn't do anything more than that, because I didn't know how to explain it. But it's basically, if you switch between two languages, so you're thinking in one language but you're speaking in another, actually impacts on how you measure time. So they watched a video, and I think they listened to some audio clips, and it came out, they would say, how long was that clip? And they used fMRI scanners, and if it switched to another language, they actually found that the way that they perceived this time was different, and there was such a thread between those native speakers that again it was too much to be a coincidence.
See, you don't do yourself enough credit. You say, oh no, I couldn't possibly explain that eloquently, and you explained it very, very eloquently. Well, there we go.
Thanks.
Some good science. Our second story this week is about a lady called Zeynep Tufekci. She is a academic and very active protester, and she's got a new book coming out called Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power of Fragility, Power and Fragility of Network Protests. It's out on May 16th. She's an incredibly interesting individual. She spent years researching the effects of social media and smartphones on how people protest. And obviously this is at a time when, once again, people are taking to the streets to protest against things like Brexit, Donald Trump, and more seriously in countries where freedoms really, really, really are under threat, the Arab Spring in recent years, and things like that. So she wanted to really examine what effect are they having, rather than just kind of make generalizations about it.
So was she a researcher? Like, what's her background?
So she grew up in Turkey, and she now works as an associate professor at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina. So this is her day job. She spends time at protests, with protesters, understanding how they're interacting with each other, how they're organizing themselves. And she, so we profile her in the current issue of Wired magazine. It's a really, really fascinating article. She's got some very interesting things to say. And the article opens with this scene that she was telling our reporter about. From January 2011 in Cairo's Tahrir Square during the big protests that were there, there was urgent need for medical supplies. And 1,600 kilometers away, someone on Twitter set up a crowdfunding campaign and raised £32,000 to buy two surgical machines to treat tear gas injuries. And Zinyup argues that the inspiration for things like that, it goes back to people that want to sell cupcakes or make something go viral on the internet. It's just using very, very basic tools and repurposing them in order to give protests this sudden power. And obviously, as someone that grew up in Turkey, so she was a programmer working for IBM in the 1990s, the internet wasn't available there. So she's very used to using technology to circumvent censorship and draconian regimes. And now she's looking at how, now that we all have access to these technologies, well, what does that mean for the way that people try and hit out against regimes that are taking them down? And what's super interesting about it is she argues that it doesn't necessarily make people more effective. In fact, it makes protests less powerful.
Why?
In what sense?
So, I don't know. So when Donald Trump came into power, I went on a couple of the protests in London, and I was thinking about this as well. You know, you've got an awful lot of people that have come together and could have some meaningful results out of that. But people turn up, they shout some slogans, they wave some banners, they make a lot of noise, and then they disappear again. And it's very difficult to keep that momentum going. And the reason that it's difficult is because it's very easy to disseminate the information about the protest, but it's very difficult to then build movements, because no one's fundamentally, these people are connected, but they're not connected. So within that protest against Donald Trump that was outside Downing Street in London, there could have been people from my postal code area in London, people that were just down my road, people that I knew might have been there, but social media doesn't really allow you to connect with them. So she said of far greater value would be people going to these protests and being organized within the protest group, this mass of people being organized by geography. So, for example, I live in the SW16 postcode in London. So everyone from that postcode would be in one block within the protest. And then you start having conversations and you talk about, well, not just Donald Trump, but you might talk about pollution problems or
things
kids
in your
getting
area
safely
or
to school.
Those sorts of things. Like, it suddenly adds a community.
Community garden projects. Everything.
That's really interesting, though, because presumably one of the advantages of having this technology is that it can connect people who don't necessarily live closely to another. So
yes,
it's almost like she wants to use this technology to go back to how activism used to be when it wasn't available.
So
to kind of support more traditional forms of activism, I suppose.
Yeah, so she refers to the March on Washington in 1963 and the Alabama bus boycotts. And she argues that they were only possible, that these huge moments, these huge political shifts were only possible because for years people were working to build community links, to understand what the problems were and to really, really engage and relate with them. And the internet makes it possible to have these really, really large-scale protests very, very quickly. But the actual work behind them that's needed to make change happen isn't there. So she puts it like this: you're developing your biceps but not your legs. There's no shortcut to doing the work. It's like being an athlete. You have to exercise to build your muscles.
It feels to me a little bit like, you know, when people criticize if something bad happens or there's a charity thing, like the ASL stuff was a prime example, where it's very easy to go on Facebook and say "Je suis Charlie" or to change your profile picture or to tweet a hashtag or something, but it doesn't do anything in the long term, but people feel like they've done something. So it's almost like this. It's like, oh, I've gone to the protest, but then it's taking that step on. That's basically what she's saying, isn't it? It's that sort of thing.
That a handful of people that have a very strong local physical connection, neighbours, if they get together, just 20 or so people, they can have a far greater impact than tens of thousands of people signing an online protest. So she says, I'd rather have 50 people in one zip code connect with one another in every zip code. That's where the power lies. It's in these small networks of people that are still connected in the real world And while technology is an amazing tool, it doesn't necessarily lead to the change that it feels like it should. And the interview that we published with her ends on a really interesting note. So as I say, she's published this book that's based on years and years of research. And she was just about to finish it. She was traveling back on a holiday that she'd been on in Turkey, going back to Istanbul to complete the final edits on her book. And her return flight was grounded because of a coup against President Erdogan. And rather than clamping down on the internet, as might have been the case in years gone by, what Erdogan did was use technology to regain control of his country. So he addressed the entire nation using FaceTime. And he was able to do that because mobile operators were forced to top up people's credit, to open up bandwidth, and to make FaceTime work so that everyone... He didn't need broadcasters because the broadcasters had been... I think they'd been raided. Some of them had been shut down. There were power cuts maybe as well, I'm not sure. But he was able to get his message out on FaceTime. So all of a sudden... Erdogan was using technology in an incredibly, incredibly powerful way. And it wasn't something that she considered. So the final chapter of her book, in response to what she experienced on that plane as it was grounded, is called The Government Strikes Back.
Wow. I suppose that's a potential drawback of these technologies as well. Obviously, there's things you can do to try and hide your identity and so on. But, you know, often they do... potentially leave a trace and put your data out there in a way that meeting someone face to face might not.
Exactly. Yeah, and I find it that when you meet people that you've only ever met on the internet, you know, people have Twitter meetups. I know there's a few people in the office that go to them quite often. Matt Burgess. and it's quite odd because you're very used to speaking to them in a certain way and being a certain person, and then you meet them in real life and they're like, oh, you're actually quite different. But it's such an encouraging sign to when people do start to take these online social groups and beyond that, online political movements potentially offline. And from what Zeynep says, that's where the power lies, that's where the difference can happen. But just as activists are still trying to wrangle with how WhatsApp groups and Facebook and Twitter and you name it can help their political movements, well, their adversaries are catching up, and they're not just catching up, they're going past them, because arguably they have, particularly in a country like Turkey, which is very, very politically unstable. Well, Erdogan is certainly an interesting individual. He's able to use his huge power to get control of technology. And it's really, really interesting. So you can read the full profile in the current issue of Wired magazine. And there's a fantastic portrait shot that we did of Zeynep, which I encourage you all to go and check out. It's a really, really amazing photograph. Our third story this week is less of a story and more of an introduction. So, Vicky Turk, 2 weeks in to Wired, and we hired you, amongst other things, but to lead a new section of the magazine called Work Smarter. Tell people about Work Smarter.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's very exciting. Obviously, I am delighted to be joining you guys here at Wired. And yeah, to be announcing this new section. So it's called Work Smarter. It's all about business, entrepreneurship, work, productivity. And it's all about getting an insight into the kind of lives and mindset of people who we admire and look up to here at Wired. So
I'm looking at it now. It's great.
It's great, right?
It's a really, really different thing for us to be doing. I think there's been elements of this hidden throughout the magazine for years, but to bring it all together into something that someone can look at and really understand where interesting things are happening, what interesting people are doing, and what they can learn from them. Lots of inspiring stories, but also lots of really interesting little snippets of information.
I think that's what's interesting to me, is there's such a wealth of information, like business books and how-to books and stuff. But what the whole thinking behind Work Smarter was it wants to give that insight. It wants to... So, Vicky, you can talk about the startup cities, but it's not just, oh, here's a list of startups that are working in a certain city, and you can get that on Wikipedia or what have you. This is telling you, okay, where are the deals done? Where should you eat? All those sorts of things actually really matter if you're living in those sorts of places.
Yeah, exactly. It's really trying to get kind of behind the scenes, I guess, of those kind of businesses and how they work. So we've got, in the first section, which is out in the current issue of Wired, we've got interviews with some amazing people. So we've got a big interview with Ellen MacArthur, obviously probably best known for sailing solo around the world in 2005, I think it was.
No mean feat.
I know. Incredible, right? And she's now doing something completely different. She's with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. She's focused on the circular economy, which is basically a kind of economic model that's focused on reducing waste and sort of completely rethinking economics, really. But anyway, she talks a lot about how she's taken lessons from sailing and applied them to this completely different initiative. And I think it gives a real sort of insight into the, her way of thinking and how she's managed to achieve so much in her life so far.
Yeah, and it, what we've also tried to do, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's an awful lot of, without wanting to go back to the swearing, there's an awful lot of BS around this sort of thing, around productivity and life
marketing
hacks.
Marketing terms and all that sort of stuff.
And it's about cutting through all of that and just giving people access to interesting individuals with amazing stories to tell.
And real stories as well, you know. We want to hear about challenges people have faced as well as their successes, you know, and things
when
that you might not think
solo
about
around the world, you know. you've earned yourself a platform to talk about how people can help can achieve really, really quite remarkable things.
But what I really like about the section is that yes, it's Work Smarter and we talk a lot about startups and entrepreneurs and things like that, but I took away things from that. I'm not running a startup, I'm not an entrepreneur, but there's a how to boost productivity through noise. Now, that's just something that I can use on a day-to-day basis. So it's not this section that's set up just for businesses. Actually, there's a lot of really useful tips in there that you can just use on a day-to-day basis that are actually, like what you were saying about MacArthur using her skills from one thing into another, that's sort of what sums up this section.
Yeah, and without wanting to keep tooting our horn too much.
Tooting our hoon.
Tooting our hoon. Startup cities. So every year for the last few years, we published a supplement in Wired in the autumn where we go to Europe's main startup hubs. So the Londons and Parises and Stockholms and Berlins of the continent. But in Work Smarter, we're kind of going beyond those to the lesser known places. There's a strange city I've never heard of called Manchester.
So in the first section, again, we've got a focus on Manchester. So we've highlighted some of the startups there that are doing really interesting things. And also, you know, places to stay, places to eat, and giving a bit of an overview of what's going on in the city. Because, you know, it's very easy when you're talking about this kind of thing to focus on the big cities, London, Berlin, all of the capitals. But, you know, we have to remember there's really exciting, interesting stuff going on everywhere. And yeah, it's our job to uncover that and let our readers and listeners know about it. So
joke, but it turns out that, you know, there's an awful lot of amazing stuff happening in Manchester and Edinburgh and all over the place. So we're going to be going into the cities that don't get enough love and really should get a lot more love, and talking a lot more about them and bringing greater awareness to them so that, you know, they have a bit more publicity, which is a good thing for them and a good thing for us, and hopefully a good thing for the readers at home as well. So what else is going in this shiny new bit of the magazine?
Well, we've got interviews with other people and profiles. We've got an interview in this one with Chris Morton, who's the CEO of Lyst, the fashion search engine. We've got a profile of the VC fund Atomico, which is actually one of my favourites because I think it's one of those aspects of business that is, there's a lot of kind of mythologizing around and a lot of misconceptions. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't really understand how VC funds or funding at all really works. So that one I think is really interesting. It's kind of demystifying the process of, you know, how these people choose what to invest in and how the whole process works.
Yeah, what they do.
Yeah,
who spend a lot of time talking about venture capitalists. What does that actually mean?
And usually they're only mentioned in, you know, in relation to a big deal they've just done or something they've invested in. And so we're trying to look at the people behind that and how it works.
But again, to sort of encourage people, that Work Smarter is meant to be this inspirational thing. I know it sounds like we're going on this massive promo, but we're not. We really do believe these things. We really do think these things.
And it's beautifully designed as
and
well.
And it is beautifully designed. And I think it is meant to be inspirational. So if you are a smaller startup who just don't know where, you've got a great idea for something, you don't know how to get started, these sorts of things are opening doors to those sorts of people, which I really liked.
And if I hope so, yeah, that would be great to hear. And, you know, if anyone has any feedback, it would be great to hear that as well.
Who are you on Twitter? Because this is how we do it.
I am at Vicky Turk. That's Vicky with an I, or two I's.
Two I's.
And V-I-C-K-I.
V-I-C-K-I.
T-U-R-K.
There you go, Vicky Turk.
Oh, I should also mention as well, we are launching the online hub of this section next week on wired.co.uk.
So if you don't have the shiny version of the magazine, then as with all of Wired's content, we call it content
stories.
In the office, stories, journalism, reporting, you can find it online in a few weeks. And if none of that tickles you, takes your fancy, then there's a comic as well. we've also got a comic in Work Smarter, which is really good fun. So it's great to have you here. It's great to have a new section in the magazine. It's great to have a new look magazine. It's been a very exciting week. There's never been quite so much chirping and people excitedly flicking through the magazine in the office in quite some time. So it's been really great to see it all come together. And we should give a quick mention to the cover feature. So it's How Russia Hacked the Internet. And this is months and months of work, led very much by our editor, Greg, to really get under the skin of this story that's getting into all aspects of our lives, both political and non-political, about how Russia has never really stopped some of the Cold War games that it was playing. It's merely hidden them online, and how that's come into very sharp relief around the election in the US and some other things that have been happening.
Someone shared the, I saw someone on Twitter shared the cover with the Russian embassy, so they know about it.
Which is very nice. I'm sure Greg is absolutely delighted to have the glaring eyes of the Russian state on him. But it's not some sort of hit piece. We've really spoken to people with an awful lot of knowledge on this, the likes of the current head of GCHQ, or the former head of GCHQ, Gary Kasparov.
The National Cybersecurity Centre.
Gordon Carrera, who's security correspondent for the BBC and has done an awful lot of research in this area. So it should hopefully provide a very useful and in-depth and considered briefing on something that there's a lot of hysteria about, but a lot to worry about as well. So we hope you enjoy reading it as much as we enjoy putting it together. Let us know what you think of Work Smarter at Vicky Turk on Twitter. I am at Jay Templeton, and you are
at Vicky Wollaston. VickyWollaston.
Vicky loves reading out her email address.
I actually had to get it changed. So because I have to spell out my surname every single time, I've changed it now to it's just victoria@wired.co.uk. So I'm sorry that's taken.
You're going to be getting all my mail.
And you've just read it out on the podcast. So if anyone wants to email me, it's Victoria, VickTorIA, at wired.co.uk.
There is a very quick way to know how to remember the spelling of my surname. Dad always uses it when he phones contact centres. It's two O's, two L's, as in
There we go. So I can use the beep again right there. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.